between worldview and ideology. It's very important in this divided world we live in. It isn't enough simply to find worldview, just simply as you view the world. The Summit Ministries, as I mentioned last week, their worldview dictionary defines worldview as any ideology, philosophy, theology, movement, or religion. They come up with five ways that provides an overarching approach to understanding God, the world, and man's relation to God and the world. So they bring God into it, because, you know, atheists have bring God into it. They say, well, we don't believe in God. So it's obviously their worldview, but God and how you view man's relation to God and the world is very important to a worldview. Fundamental to a worldview is I'm just going to quote it again, the overarching approach to understanding God, the world, and man's relation to God and the world. And we celebrated our nation's independence just this last week. You couldn't ignore it with all the bombs blasting and, you know, going off in the neighborhood, right? And depending on the neighborhood, you had more bombs going off. Unfortunately, we moved to a neighborhood where just two houses down, they were doing the big stuff. But one of our neighbors shut them down early, so that part of it was good. But did you know that the Declaration of Independence expresses a worldview? Hopefully you knew that. It mentions God at least four times. It talks about, number one, the laws of nature and of nature's God. Two, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mankind gets their rights from God, not the government. We always have to keep that, our Creator God and not the government. We always have to keep that in mind. Number three, the Declaration appeals to the supreme judge of the world. And that was a quote. So with a capital S and a capital J, the supreme judge of the world is not a man, but God. Number four, the Declaration relies on the support and a firm reliance on, quote, the protection of divine, capital P, providence. God is in our Declaration of Independence, and it's obvious. And I was reading another article that says, you know, you cannot separate our Declaration from the Constitution, and our founding fathers meant for those two documents to go together. You can't have one without the other. The bottom line is that our Declaration of Independence does a pretty good job of providing an overarching approach to understanding God, the world, and man's relation to God and the world, according to the definition of worldview. And we would consider that a Christian worldview. Now, we wouldn't look at the Declaration of Independence as completely defining and articulating a worldview, but it's got enough elements in it so that it's obvious, and that's its framework. God is our Creator. God created us equal. God is our supreme judge, and God governs in the affairs of mankind. If we would just keep those, if we would just have those, that basic framework in every American, a lot of our problems would go away. Now that's worldview. Now on to ideology. Ideology falls under the umbrella of worldview, as we read the definition earlier. And again, as Summit defines ideology, quote, the doctrines, opinions, or way of thinking of an individual or group. Now, typically, we talk about ideology when we are talking about a group. All right? Ideology is the ideas and allegiances that motivate a group, pretty much any group. We categorize ourselves into lots of groups. You probably would put yourself into a myriad of groups. There are a lot of boomers in here, right? We group things by age. We have Cubs fans, and we have Sox fans, and if you've gone to the dark side, you're a St. Louis Cardinals fan, all right? You know, we have these rivalries between groups, and they can cause fights at baseball games. That's how passionate we are about that stuff. Last week I mentioned groups like you could be part of a union, you could be part of a racial group. Well, you could be. You are part of a racial group. Let's just say it that way. And as promised that last week, today we're going to see ideology in action in a big way. In fact, a racist ideology in action. Now, we don't want to take, you got to be careful. You can always take, I think what I'm saying, too extreme sometimes. It's okay to take pride in your race. You know, I like seeing the Mexican flags fly sometimes on the cars. You know, they're driving down, you know, they're proud of it. You know, you get Irish flags. You know, people that have come to this America are proud of where they came from. Except if you're the race in power, then you got to shut up about your race. So that's just kind of the way things operate in our country right now. But racist ideology, even if you aren't the race in power, is still just as wrong. Still not right. Well, the title of today's sermon is Uncle Paul. Paul is like a modern-day Uncle Tom. You know who Uncle Tom is? Well, Uncle Tom is a black person who is too friendly with someone white. And according to the Jews, Paul is too friendly with another racial group. But just like Uncle Tom, Paul really is the good guy. I learned something new this week. Well, turn to Acts chapter 22, verse 17, if you're not already there. It's on page 1107. Acts chapter 22, verse 17, page 1107. And I'm going to begin by reading verses 20 to 21. So, I'm sorry, 17 to 21. Now remember, Paul is, we're entering, Paul is in the middle of his speech. The crowd is hushed. And he's speaking to them. He's talking about his testimony and how he got blinded and what Jesus said to him. And he continues his speech in verse 17. When I had returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple, I fell into a trance and saw him being Jesus, saying to me, "Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me." And I said, "Lord, they themselves know that in one synagogue after another I imprisoned and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of Stephen, your witness, was being shed, I myself was standing by and approving and watching over the garments of those who killed him." And he said to me, "Go, for I am sending you far away to the Gentiles." So Jesus speaks to Paul through a trance and basically tells him to get out of town. And I think it's hilarious. What does Paul do? He's arguing with Jesus. Now, is it ever a good idea to argue with Jesus? No, it's not, in case you didn't know the answer to that question. And maybe Paul would say, "No, Jesus and I were having a discussion." We do that sometimes when you're having an argument with somebody. "No, we weren't arguing. We're just having a discussion." No, Paul was arguing with him. And what does Jesus say? He doesn't get it. He just says, "Go, for I'm going to send you far away to the Gentiles." And Paul quotes him exactly, apparently. And what's Paul doing? Once again, just like last week, he's relating to his audience. He says, "I was just like you guys, but I've had a change of heart." Paul had approved of Stephen's death, as did his audience. Well, the situation goes nuclear in verses 22 to 24. "Up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, 'Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live.' And as they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, the tribune ordered him to be brought into the barracks, saying that he should be examined by flogging to find out why they were shouting against him like this." Up to this word. And what was that word? Gentiles. Pshh, kaboom. Death to Paul was their response. Just for that one word. And what else did they do? They acted like kindergartners. I think this is so funny. They took off their cloaks and they're throwing dust in the air. Why did they take off their cloaks? I guess maybe because they didn't want to get it dirty. They're going to bring up a sweat. I don't know. But they're flinging dust, throwing dirt in the air. Who does that? Kindergartners throw dirt in the air. Just this week, I was mowing the grass, and I found a rock in the middle of my yard. I'm like, How'd that get there? Then I remembered my kindergartner age grandkids were playing in the, we've got like, former owner had put like, kind of like this little rock place with stones in it, and they took one of those rocks and they threw it out in the grass. So I got to tell my grandkids when they come over today, by the way, don't throw rocks on my grass. I don't want to run over with my lawnmower. That's what kids do. Well, how racist can you get? Paul just mentions the word Gentiles, and they go bananas. They can't keep it on an adult level. They go crazy. And we see again what Roman justice looks like. And weeks ago, Paul was assumed guilty. So this guy's getting beaten by the crowd. And what does the Romans do? They come up and they arrest the guy getting beaten. That just seems so wrong. Now Paul is about to get a flogging to find out why they were shouting against him. Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's just flog the guy who's, you know, the crowd's going crazy. Well, the Romans were brutal. Well, racism shows up again in verses 25 to 29. But when they had stretched him out for the whips, Paul said this to the centurion who was standing by, "Is it lawful for you to flog a man who is a Roman citizen and uncondemned?" When the centurion heard this, he went to the tribune and said to him, "What are you about to do? This man is a Roman citizen." So the tribune came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" This is just so funny. "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" He said, "Yes." The tribune answered, "I bought this citizenship for a large sum." Paul said, "But I am a citizen by birth." So those who were about to examine him withdrew from him immediately. And the tribune was also afraid, for he realized that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he had bound him. Well, let's not turn to our sermon note sheets yet, but so how racist are the Romans? This is hilarious. Is it lawful to flog a... Apparently it's lawful to flog an uncondemned man who is not a Roman. If you're a Roman, it's bad, but if you're not a Roman, let's just flog somebody who's getting beat up, you know? Different standards for Roman citizens compared to everyone else. It's kind of racist, isn't it? That's an abominable standard for modern day ears. Or is it? In a Roman world, it's okay to purchase your citizenship and receive a different standard of justice. And what does that mean? That means the rich are going to have if you can afford to buy your citizenship, you're going to get a standard, you know, a different standard of justice. Is that right? Shouldn't be, but again, kind of happens today in this world. However, since Paul was a Roman citizen by birth, they backed off in a heartbeat. Birth was much better. But we do the same thing today. Think about this. We want to identify with a group to our advantage when we can. Think about two politicians, Barack Obama. So Barack Obama, this is interesting. Beth came up with this question, not me. So Barack had one black parent and one white parent. Okay? 75% of the people in our country are apparently white, something like that, and 13% are black. So who does Barack Obama identify with? Well, he's 50-50. I think this is always hilarious. So he identifies with black. Why? Because it's to his advantage. We would never probably ever heard of Barack Obama if he didn't identify as black. Oh, let's, you know, the blacks, you know, let's get him as a senator in Illinois, and da, 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 da. He's first black president, blah, blah, blah. Kamala Harris, she had one black parent and one Indian, Asian Indian, not Indian, not, you know, I mean, Asian Indian. You got to be careful. So how does she identify? Does she identify with the one with the least amount of minority and between her parentage? No, she identifies with the majority minority in a sense in her. So she identifies as black to her advantage. She was using her race to political advantage. Is that right or wrong? That's wrong. whether you're white, black, pink, blue, brown, whatever. Well, now let's turn to our, pull out your sermon note sheets. Today, I think we are seeing how even more Acts is a political book. And what are the two P's that are needed for politics? What drives politics? What are the two P's, class? It's been a while since I've said these. Power and people. You got people in power, you got politics. You got people in power in a church, you got politics. We cannot avoid it. As Christians, sometimes we need to address it head on. Well, so I think this passage is giving us a warning. It's what the Jews did. Don't let your ideology reject the gospel. An ideology is the word for the answer. One of these days we'll get, that's one of the things we need to do, Beth, when we come in and prepare the slides here, is put the answers ready on the screen, but didn't have time for that. Don't let your ideology reject the gospel. So the Jews were so caught up in their group that they rejected Paul's testimony because he mentioned the bad guys. He mentioned those evil Gentiles. And this can apply to Christians and non-Christians. Christians, your ideology could cause you to act in contradiction to the gospel, to Jesus. If you're racist, obviously that's one way to do it. But if you support racists, do it. And we're going to talk about something racist. That it's so interesting how the timing of this sermon coincided with some actions that happened this week. As Christians, you can assume that another race is you can assume that they're guilty. You know, do you ever have somebody following you and happen to be a black guy, and you're thinking, oh, are you more worried about him or a white guy following you? You know, there's just these subtle little ways that we could show it, you know. Now, sometimes there is reason to, if you're walking on the south side of Chicago or something like that, maybe there are times to be careful about that, but we cannot create the assumption of guilt. We had one person here that assumed that white woman who accidentally tased or she accidentally shot instead of tased him up in Minnesota. She goes, oh, she meant to do that. Well, that's the assumption of guilt. It goes both ways. And non-Christians, we do this, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this as non-Christians. We're going to see the ideology of race in our passage. Obviously, the Jews weren't Christians, but they were so incensed against the Gentiles. They were so connected to their group that just mentioning the word Gentiles caused them to go crazy. So what event happened this week? Supreme Court struck down affirmative action like they should have. Well, let's get into the points, and I'll get into this in a second. Your racism rejects the gospel when, number one, it blinds you to gospel truth. Kind of already talked about that a little bit. I wasn't sure how to wordsmith this thing. Your racism rejects the gospel when it blinds you to gospel truth. And there's a lot of truths about the gospel that we could talk about. We're not going to get into all those today, but the Jews were rejecting Paul's testimony about Jesus because they were racist. We see this today. Oh, Christianity is a white man's religion. No, Christianity is not a white man's religion. Now, we all turn Jesus into whatever race we are. Have you seen a black Jesus? There are those. There's a Chinese Jesus, in the typical white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Jesus. It's like the most famous picture of Jesus of all time is this kind of meek Jesus, this white guy, with blonde. I'm sure if I showed you the picture up here, I think I have actually one time, I showed that picture. We all tend to turn Jesus into who we are. I remember Tony Campolo. he was, I don't know if he was teaching or he was in Sunday school. He walked into, I don't know if it was a black church, and I can't remember if it was a Chinese Jesus or whatever. And he goes, hey, Jesus wasn't black or Chinese or whatever. And there's this black guy sitting there, and he goes, and he wasn't a honky neither. Oh, that is so true. We turn Jesus into white man Jesus. I've never seen a Hispanic Jesus, but Joey, maybe you have. I'm sure, you know, we do that. We turn Jesus into the who we are. We worship ourselves in the way we worship Jesus. Any heart is capable of racism. Well, number two, you treat others differently. Your race differently is the answer. Your racism rejects the gospel when you treat others differently. Now, Chief Justice Roberts has two great quotes. He said, the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Now, how simple is that? It's like, well, duh. You know, sometimes the simplest truths are the most obvious truths are most simplest. Now, when they were arguing the case, this affirmative action case with Harvard and I think it was North Carolina, so here's part of the transcript from their testimony. Just Robert said, so we're talking about race as a determining factor in admission to Harvard. Okay, now if you remember, the Asians had brought a case. Hey, we're being discriminated against. And so that was the, you know, that was the, you know, it was, Asians were, so again, you had racism involved. So the lawyer for the Harvard, whatever, said, race for some highly qualified applicants can be the determinative factor, just as being an oboe player in a year in which the Harvard Radcliffe Orchestra needs an oboe player will be the, in which the orchestra needs an oboe player will be the tip. And then Robert says, we did not fight a civil war about oboe players. We did fight a civil war to eliminate racial discrimination, and that's why it's a matter of considerable concern. Well, affirmative action was racist in this case. They were choosing Asians. And if you read the look, I like looking at the Babylon Bee. I think they're kind of tasteless. But one of their jokes, one of their things this week was, the Asian students celebrate the affirmative action victory by taking a 5-minute study break. You know, Asians are known for studying hard. They deserve, you know, they work hard. I didn't like competing against Asians. You know, I went to the University of Illinois engineering class. They were some of the smartest people that were there. They got better grades than this white boy did, much better. Well, Charles, you know, it's just if you've probably heard the news, it's just they just went ballistic over this thing. Charles Barkley, I think he still is a conservative. He said, quote, I'm leaving Auburn $5 million. Barkley said, following the Supreme Court's affirmative action ruling, quote, I'm going to change it just to be just for scholarships for black students. That's just my way of trying to make sure Auburn stays diverse. Well, that's kind of ridiculous. I mean, he's making a statement. I don't think he really thinks that Auburn isn't going to be diverse. With so much diversity and everything going on in society, that can be a good thing. We want to do unto others as do unto you. But the problem is, sometimes helping hurts. And I've quoted Thomas Sowell a lot here, and I'm going to read this a little bit longer quote here. This is Thomas, a black guy, one of my favorite black economists. He's just so right on so much. He goes to, and this was before there was, he was talking about Justice Anton Scalia when he was alive about another Supreme Court case. So Sowell says, despite much media spin, the issue is not whether blacks in general should be admitted to higher ranked or lower ranked institutions. The issue is whether a given black student, when given academic qualifications, should be admitted to a college or university where he would not be admitted if he were white. So that's so smart. Like, well, if a white guy isn't going to be admitted, why should a black guy be? And then he goes, Sol is a data guy. I'm a data guy, so I love data guys. I became painfully aware of the problem more than 40 years ago when I was teaching at Cornell University and discovered that half the black students were on some form of academic probation. It wasn't because they were black, because they weren't meeting the standards. Those students were not stupid or uneducable. On the contrary, the average black student at Cornell at that time scored at the 75th percentile on scholastic tests. Their academic qualifications were better than three-quarters of all American students who took the test. That's pretty good. The average white student would have been wiped out at Cornell, like me. But the average white student was unlikely to be admitted to Cornell in the first place, nor was a white student who scored at the 75th percentile. Now he's going to talk about why that was bad. He goes, that was a favor reserved for black students. That this favor turned black students who would have been successful at most American colleges and universities into failures at Cornell. So was helping them? No, it was hurting them. It was turning them into failures. And he says, none of this was particular to Cornell. Nearly one fourth of these black students with stellar qualifications, he's talking about MIT, nearly one fourth of these black students with stellar qualifications in math failed to graduate from MIT. And those who did graduate were concentrated in the bottom tenth of the class. Why? Because they didn't meet the rigorous standards for that university, so it was hurting them. Justice Scalia was not, Sowell goes on, talking about sending black students to substandard colleges and universities to get an inferior education. You may, in fact, get a much better education. Listen to this carefully. You may, in fact, get a much better education at an institution that teaches at a pace that you can handle and master. In later life, no one is going to care how fast you learn something, so long as you know it. That is so right. That is so important. I actually wish, in some ways, I hadn't gone to the University of Illinois because its pace was above me, and I was a C or C plus student. Mismatching students with educational institutions is a formula for needless failures. The book Mismatch by Sander and Taylor is a first-rate study of the hard facts. It shows, for example, that the academic performances of black and Hispanic students rose substantially after affirmative action admissions policies were banned in the University of California system. Sometimes our helping hurts. Now back to Uncle Tom. Everybody knows probably who Tim Scott is by now. I always thought of Uncle Tom as a negative thing. Well, listen to this story. So I saw this article come up because I just did, you know, Uncle Tom and just see what came up. So this guy wrote an article, Tim Scott is no Uncle Tom. It was written by Dr. Willie Cobb Jr. But he's got a twist, and I think it's all important for us to know this. This is the last illustration, and again, I apologize for reading a little bit much here, but so he talks about his anger and fear and frustration over, you know, the black and African-American communities, and he said, after President Joe Biden gave his address to Congress following his first 100 days in office, the Republican response from the only black Republican senator in Congress is one of the most maddening and upsetting responses that I've ever heard. Senator Tim Scott said some things that were so insulting that he could have been a segregationist, conservative, white senator. He's acting just like those Jews. It's like, ah. A few days later, VP Harris gave a similarly ridiculous response. Her response proves that black and African American communities can barely trust any politician whether they are Democrat or Republican, whether they are black or white. These politicians do not have a genuine concern for the community, a population that has suffered generational pain and misery. And then he goes on to say, why? He says, they both said that the United States was not at all a racist nation. They were both playing politics with the lives of black and African American people. They were both selling out the black community. And then he said, Tim Scott said that he had been called an Uncle Tom. That is an insult to the real Uncle Tom. Most people don't understand that the common understanding about Uncle Tom is all a misperception perpetrated mainly by the black community on the black community and from movies like The Song of the South. Uncle Tom was a fictional character from the book Uncle Tom's. Now, I've never read Uncle Tom's Cabin, so I'm taking his, you know. And by the way, what I'm reading here, I got from another website, so I thought, well, is this guy crazy? But no. He was a fictional character from the book Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe and loosely based on the great Josiah Henson, a real person, a self-educated freed slave who fought for the civil rights and the freedom of other black people. Josiah Henson was so revered that he was greeted by the Queen of England and had dinner at the White House with the president. He was a regal, intelligent, and charismatic black man who fought for the freedom of black people from England to Canada to the United States. Tim Scott was right. He implied that it is an insult to call him an Uncle Tom. I agree. He is no Uncle Tom. Tim Scott is more like Uncle Ruckus. Who knows who Uncle Ruckus is? Uncle Ruckus is a black character and I guess it's a cartoon called Boondocks. I've never seen it. But he's a black guy who hates black people. So this guy is calling Tim Scott a black guy who hates black people. And here's how he said, at some point, Uncle Tom became derogatory for black people. And so there's this legend that he believes. Now, whether it's right or wrong, but somehow Uncle Tom went from becoming a positive thing to becoming derogatory. And here he says, Abraham Lincoln so enjoyed the book Uncle Tom's Cabin that he would use it as inspiration to start the Civil War. Before this time, Uncle Tom was considered a hero both to black and white people alike. And here's where he thinks it went off the rails. When Josiah Henson got old and was ready to retire, a group of young people came to him and asked him to continue to fight for civil rights. He told them he was too old. It was their turn to continue the fight. They told him he could not retire. There is still fighting to do. Josiah Henson said, I'm tired. Now it's up to you young people to continue to carry on the struggle. They said they were so upset that they were going to turn the name Uncle Tom into a dignified, fighting, compassionate term to a name meaning sellout to the black community. So that's one version of why it became a sellout. That's why I've titled this sermon Uncle Paul. The Jews thought Uncle Paul was selling out to the Jewish community just because he was friendly towards the Gentiles. Now, from one perspective, I guess an affirmative action plan wouldn't be all that bad. Think about the Declaration of Independence and all the things that it affirms about being created equal, but in its worldview. But it misses one part of the worldview, I think, in the Declaration. And perhaps our Constitution and Declaration gets something right. There is something that in equalness about us. We are all one race, aren't we? We are one race. We're all like Adam and Eve. We're all descendants from them. We're created by God, and we're all born equal. We're born equal in value, but not in ability. And that's what's going. I think that's what's wrong with this. We think that we all should have the same outcome, and that's called equity. Well, that's not true. We don't do equity in the National Basketball Association, otherwise you'd have 5-6 white guys like me running around. No, that'd be ridiculous. But we're also all born under the sentence of death. Thankfully, God had an affirmative action plan. If he didn't have one of affirmative action plan of sorts, we would all be sentenced to death by the supreme judge of all the world. Thankfully, God is involved in the affairs of men, and God became a man in Jesus Christ to save us all of our evil hearts. Men from every nation and tribe and tongue and language will stand before the throne, before Judge Jesus, and we will worship him. And we will cry out together and say, salvation belongs to our God and to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. We all have that same hope, whether black, white, Jew, Gentile. And as Paul said, you know, it was kind of funny. And if you look at verse 22:15, it says, I am sending you to everyone. And then Paul gets specific and says, I am sending you far away to the Gentiles. And they go ballistic. So may we have the hearts of Paul and share Christ with everyone we meet, regardless of race. Let's pray. Heavenly Father,